Our guest on Take It From Us today fairly describes herself as wounded. Wounded by an abusive and controlling upbringing, by family upheaval and discrimination, by serious physical ill health, and a mental health diagnosis of complex post-traumatic stress disorder. That diagnosis is apparently not included in the Bibles of mental health diagnosis, which made it even more difficult for her to get help and support. Because the story from our guest is traumatic and involves family members, we've agreed to only mention her Christian name, and we pre-recorded the interview as well late last week. Her name is Sharon, and here is her story. And that story slowly emerged during a Take It From Us training, a radio training workshop, which was put together to stimulate consumer participation in our mental health radio show. Well, welcome, Sharon, to Take It From Us. What was life like growing up?
Thank you, Sheldon. I grew up in the Waikato in the 1960s, and I grew up on a farm. It was a mixed stock farm, they called in those days. And it was a beautiful environment. Physically, I had considerable freedom to move around. I enjoyed the animals and the beautiful scenery, the plants. But there was a difficulty in that my family was quite violent, and it was hidden from most people, so it was something that was happening without anybody else knowing.
So that nice environment that you had away from the family home, it gave you an opportunity to escape?
Yes, it did. I had access to a lot of little farm huts, and I would take a few toys out with me and set up elaborate fantasies in the huts. And really what I remember is going into those fantasies and almost waking up from them hours later. So it was really escapism in the true sense.
But I understand that you also had some real treats, and that you were able to just sit very quietly in maybe in the bush or in the countryside, and animals and birds would just sort of live their lives without sort of knowing that you were there.
That's true. We had a couple of creeks nearby, and I had to cross them to get to the wool shed. So it was often in my path. And I would lie down on the side of the creek, often when it was damp, and I'd just be very still for a long time. And I did find that animals would respond by just ignoring that I was there. So I got to see things that other people didn't know about. And yes, that was a lovely feeling, beautiful.
Did you think during those times a little bit about what was happening at home and about your family?
Very seldom. I think those times I used to get away, like the times when I did reflect on it, would be sometimes I'd speak to my uncle about it. I had an uncle that lived with us, and if I was really worried, I'd sometimes speak to him, but not about my parents, only about an aunt that I had trouble with. I know it was just a time away. Mm-hmm. And maybe at that age, there's not that self-reflective ability to actually take events in your life and do that. Because I'm talking preschool here.
Oh, preschool.
Preschool.
Right.
So a very small person.
But there was no concern that this very small person was sort of wandering off? And
no. That's the downside, was that I often did hurt myself, and I would hide that because I could be punished for hurting myself. And I was in danger quite a number of times, but I learned to be safe on my own.
Mm. So words like punishment and violent family, I mean, they're very frightening, aren't they? What sort of damage was there, do you think, to that control and bullying?
I think the damage was on lots of levels, and it's taking me a lifetime probably to disentangle what it is. I think immediately what it did was it distanced me from people, and it damaged any feeling of agency, something I looked up when we were talking about this, thinking about this interview. I think the controlling was so specific around what I could do and couldn't do with my body that I didn't always have, and I sometimes don't have, a feeling of volition about what I can do.
You used the term agency. Sorry, I just
I did.
Confused about that.
So okay, I've written down a something here. Agency being, for me, a sense of subjective awareness that one is initiating, executing and controlling one's own volitional actions in the world. And it pretty well describes it.
Right. So just to help me understand that and to help our listeners understand it, is this that you lost a willingness to do things and take risks and generally be out in the world?
I think with some things it did, particularly sports. I was naturally probably quite athletic, but I couldn't take the risk to do sport in school. So yes, that kind of thing was definitely affected by it. But I also just think feeling that I could do things at all. It's hard to explain.
Well, given the extent of the control and the bullying that you have shared with me, and I should probably add that Sharon has been involved in a radio training workshop for Take It From Us, which is designed to encourage people with lived experience of mental health to participate in the radio show. And so that's the principal reason why Sharon is doing this interview. And so I've been privy to quite a bit of information about her upbringing and about the control and the bullying and the violence that occurred for her. When you say that you couldn't take the risk of playing sport at school, what risk was associated with that?
The risk was and actually engaging in it. It wasn't in winning or losing. It was just the fact of being in an uncertainty, I think.
And that uncertainty came from really your home life and the way that you were treated there.
Yes, I think the way that I have usually illustrated the type of controlling and violence that happened was a particular example of it when I was a teenager, as a ritual that my father set up where he knew I didn't like hearing knives sharpened and that I was frightened of them. And so he would tell me that I had to stand in a certain place in the kitchen and I had to look at him without blinking, without moving or saying anything, and watch while he sharpened all the knives. And I never understood exactly what was the implication of the knives, so I'd wake up in the night and think maybe I'd hear him walk down the hallway and think perhaps he was getting a knife to get me, so I thought I might actually die. And I suspect being treated like that is probably quite profoundly damaging. And afterwards, after that happened, I would often blink an eye or I'd move and that would be a reason for him to beat me. And then he'd drag me down the hallway by my hair and I'd have quite a long, severe beating.
I mean, did he have any idea or understanding or awareness of what this, what impact this was going to have and was having at the time?
I don't know if he was able to reflect on it. I don't know why he did it, except that he did seem to get some enjoyment, which sounds bizarre, but it was something that I used to see in his eyes and I found quite disturbing.
So this was an environment of great fear. I mean, at night time, as you're saying, you're hearing your father moving around, you've got a fear that your life is really at risk. I mean, how did you sustain this?
I think my first few years were divided pretty equally between feeling of surviving and living in fantasy. And some of that was fantasy that was invoked in play, another was in reading. And I guess I developed some strengths to handle the circumstances, and one of them was that I began to read before I was at school, so that by the time I went to school, I knew how to read the little readers, and none of us really know how that happened. I didn't learn formally.
Right.
But what that did was give me an outlet into fairly grown-up books at a very young age.
So it sounds as though books were available to you and there were no restrictions on those. So that was a positive.
It was a positive. We had an old bookcase with a set of encyclopedias and, as I said, some quite grown-up books. And one of the nice things my dad did was buy books for me occasionally. I didn't have enough, so I kept reading the same ones over and again, which is a bit frustrating.
And then those experiences of the countryside and the animals and I guess being in that sort of spirit and that sort of environment was a positive as well.
Yes, it was. I did really enjoy going out and spending time on my own. Another thing my parents did do for me that was positive was from when I was maybe about 9, I was allowed to take food and matches and things out into the countryside and spend the day out on my own and cook my own food and then sort of arrive home with the evening.
Right, and how old would you have been then?
I think I probably 9 would have been when I started to do that. It's quite young, so I was hurting myself. I'd get burned and all sorts of things, but it was
not intentionally. But
no, just because I was so young to be doing those things on my own.
Right.
And I learned from the experience.
And when you reflect and look back on that 9-year-old going out into the country and virtually living the day on your own, what conclusions do you come to about that experience?
Well, I don't think I would have allowed my own 9-year-olds to do that. But the conclusion I draw was that it was probably a safety valve, spending that time being away. I still do that. I still need downtime where I just spend time on my own and sort of almost process life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what would you say today to anyone who's treating family members the way you were treated?
I've thought quite a lot about this one. It's an issue that's quite dear to my heart. And my first thought is it's quite concrete, is pause. To pause before acting. And I'm thinking about that because I'm around a lot of people that I see all struggle with emotions, and I think that it's quite normal for humans to have feelings and not to know what to do with them. But that acting out feelings on other people isn't a very good idea.
I mean, the pause is actually regarded as a very positive thing, isn't it? And it allows us to catch our breath, to perhaps think a little bit more seriously about what we're going to say. I mean, people have said to me sometimes that I should think before I open my mouth, and I think perhaps that's advice that's, certainly good for me, and it's probably good for a lot of people, and it's good in the situation where there's anger or high emotion or intensity. That's what you would have liked is a bit of a pause.
I think pause, but the ability to be able to self-reflect. I don't know how people learn that, whether they learn by doing it. I suspect it is because that's how I've learned it. I mean, we seem to learn by making mistakes, humans, which is sad because we make our mistakes in the context of our family and our friends.
I've got a little sign in my apartment which says some mistakes are just too much fun to only make once.
I like that.
Yeah, but when did you first receive a mental health diagnosis?
I first received one, I think, in about 1998 when my own mother was unwell and I'd had some surgery and I was feeling quite distressed at that time. And my first diagnosis was actually depression. And I was quite baffled by the whole thing, the process that I went through when I saw a psychiatrist and the way that they came up with that diagnosis. I couldn't really understand it.
What did you do to try and understand that? Because, I mean, depression can be quite a scary label to hear, isn't it? And it's a scary diagnosis.
I think I was so certain that I didn't have what they call depression, and that I knew I got depressed sometimes, but that was only a tiny fraction of what I actually did experience. That I didn't take it seriously.
Right.
I just thought, well, they're not right, so I'll keep doing my own thing, and I just walked away and did my own thing.
But how were you feeling about life and attitudes to life and your level of sort of flourishing and enthusiasm for life?
I probably wasn't flourishing that well in 1998. I had teenagers that were acting out. I had very little support. My marriage had broken up. I had been in an abusive relationship. I'd had physical illness and a parent that was quite mentally unwell and quite unsafe to be around. And so those family issues of feeling physically unsafe had arisen again.
So this was almost like a little bit of a repetition of your upbringing?
It was, in that I actually began to fear for my safety again, and I applied for a protection order and got it immediately, and it enabled me to sever connection with that person for the time being until they decided what they were going to do.
But life, like, it doesn't sound as though it was too bright, and yet I hear you say that you were a little bit dumbfounded by the diagnosis of depression.
I was dumbfounded and I was disappointed, I think, because I'd hoped that it might be an opportunity to actually learn something and cooperate with some people to get some help. I really felt like I wasn't heard, and I found that really hard. I didn't like it.
So you're saying that you weren't heard by the specialist, by the psychiatrist?
Yes. I clearly remember talking about dissociation. I remember talking. I saw two psychiatrists, and one of them I'd met in a courtroom with that family member that I talk about, because that family member actually went through a process of court hearings with us, which were awful. They were devastating. And that the psychiatrist saw it, and I explained to her that I had been profoundly dissociated when that happened. And when I walked into the room and saw her, I had a flashback, a post-traumatic flashback. And I explained all that. And I still don't really understand why that wasn't listened to.
You've just mentioned post-traumatic flashback. Now, that did become a diagnosis, didn't it? And quite a disturbing one, in that it didn't appear in any of the the mental health Bibles.
Yes, I was given a diagnosis some years later of complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which I can read to you from Wikipedia, is a psychological injury that results from protracted exposure to prolonged social and or interpersonal trauma in the context of either captivity or entrapment. And I think that really describes pretty well what results when you have an upbringing like mine. So I resonated with the diagnosis, but it's not yet in the DSM, it's not recognised as a bona fide diagnosis.
And that made it difficult to get support again, I understand.
It did. The fact that I'm not sure that even post-traumatic stress disorder itself is considered one of the 3% of illnesses or conditions that are treated by mainstream mental health. This particular one really meant that, and being given this one meant that the people were scrabbling around for what to do. And in that process, I didn't really feel consulted by them. So what happened was I did my usual thing of reading and discovering for myself what it meant. And then I read pamphlets and all sorts of guidelines and things, so I knew what I could expect. And I went around back into that consultation quite sort of filled with optimism. And then I discovered that the guidelines just weren't followed.
What would you have liked to have happened when you went to see those clinicians or specialists?
I'd like for us all to have listened to one another and worked together to discover what would be helpful.
Do you think that you would have been then able to tell your story and tell what had happened and how you'd got to this point?
I think I would have. I suspect I was already doing that. One of the things that they would have liked me to have done was some psychotherapy. The problem was that the person that I was meant to have the psychotherapy with wasn't someone I related to particularly well, and it wasn't that I was offered a choice. It was that these people turned to each other and said, well, the psychotherapy will start next week. And I just can't really work with people in that way. I need people to ask me what suits me better.
Mm. I mean, I've heard guests on our radio show, Take It From Us, say that it's very, very important to have a positive relationship and an empathetic relationship with our psychotherapists and our psychologists and therapists and doctors and that sort of thing. And if it doesn't gel, then we should go out and find somebody else. Did you have that sort of awareness?
I did have that awareness because I'd actually had quite a lot of therapy before that, so it wasn't the first time I'd come across therapy, and I knew that I wasn't going to gel with that person, and I knew also it wasn't probably a good idea to continue to try and fit myself into doing what they wanted to do. I did try medication. I've tried that on a couple of occasions. And the annoying thing about complex PTSD is it doesn't really respond very easily to being treated with medication.
Mm. Mm. It's clear, Sharon, that it's been a tougher road for you than for most people, yet you've survived. What do you rank as your strengths that have kept you going?
I reflected on this quite a bit after we talked about it in our workshops, Sheldon. I think the thing that comes back to haunt me as a strength and maybe a weakness is that I'm curious. I like to investigate, and it can be a downfall in that I suppose I can investigate too deeply and get too immersed in things. But recently I've become more able to be curious and just stand back from things and ask myself questions. What's that about?
So curiosity is a strength, but it's also a weakness.
Yes.
So as a strength, I guess you're very keen on research on computer and that sort of thing. So how is that a strength?
My computer has been my lifeline. And during those times I talked about when I was misdiagnosed, I was able to do my own reading and meet people online. Communicate with them, tried joining a couple of support groups online, and it just got me through. It helped me to keep a sense of myself, and that I think it can be hard when somebody makes a diagnosis or says something and it doesn't gel because there's a sense of dissonance between the self and the outside world, and I guess I never lost that.
I'm interested in how curiosity has been a weakness too, because I mean I'm an ex-journalist and I guess I'm always curious about people's lives, about what keeps them going, what their thoughts are, where they've come from, that sort of thing. I can be accused of being sort of investigative and asking too many questions, and I can see that that can be disturbing for people. But how has your curiosity sort of not worked for you?
Well, I relate to the last one as well. I tend to ask too many questions sometimes. For other people, I try and moderate that because I do find asking questions can be helpful. It can buy time.
Right.
And it also can give understanding, can't it? If somebody's saying something or doing something, I don't understand that, I'd rather ask a question and find out than make a judgment about it.
It also takes the heat off us, of course, because we
does.
Don't have to tell our story.
It does, and people can turn that right back as they should. So, yes, I have both sides of that.
Right, but it sounds as though you would have liked those clinicians and specialists and therapists to have asked more questions.
I would have liked them to. And in fact, the curiosity factor was something that they offered to me as a weakness, that they said that I had done too much research and that it wasn't helpful. So that's one example of people perhaps saying that they thought that I had done too much.
But that's almost like an assumption, isn't it? I mean, I don't understand how too much research. I mean, okay, we do hear that there is some unhelpful material on the internet, particularly around mental health, perhaps. But, I mean, has your curiosity and your research and your involvement with with Google or with the web, I mean, has that led you down paths that have been unhelpful?
No, I don't think so. And maybe it was unhelpful in that it's difficult to have people that are well informed in a system that's more working by telling people how things will be we're possibly in a time of transition when people know more for the first time.
But in mental health, I mean, telling people is not exactly a good way to implement therapy, I wouldn't have thought.
No, well, I agreed with you there. I thought that we had a woeful foundation for starting any kind of therapeutic intervention.
With these specialists?
Yes. Yes, I felt really strongly that it wouldn't be safe mentally and emotionally, probably, to disclose too much to them.
Did you have enough confidence to say that, or did you just go along with the process?
No, I had confidence to say it. And the odd thing about it, I even took along an advocate, a mental health advocate, and she was amazed by what happened, by what she saw happening in that room. Mm. And she said to me, "I'm not surprised. I'm always amazed by the audacity of how people treat other people." And it was great to hear the same thing reflected back as I was noticing.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, what other strengths have got you through, more than just survival?
I think my spiritual life has been huge, and it's probably the foundation of everything else that I do because it's so much a part of me. I think I grew up in a family where I had four different close relatives who had four different religions. So I had a very early introduction to comparative religious studies.
Comparative religious studies. What does that mean?
Well, it means that they all liked the idea of having me go to whatever church they went to and read their material. And so I dutifully read the material at a young age, as I just told you, and quickly decided they couldn't all be right. So they probably all, none of them were right. That's how I decided.
Were these religions quite contrasting?
Yes, there was a fundamentalist Christian, Jehovah's Witness, Presbyterian, and Salvation Army. I know they don't all sound completely separate. They are quite different.
Well, I wouldn't think so. But all of them probably fairly strict as well.
Oh, I'd say so, yes.
Yeah, did that have an influence?
I think it did, especially with one of my grandmothers. She had very strong ideas on women and what they could and couldn't do. The upside of that was that it also got me to reflecting about our gender roles really young. Mm. So I think one of my strengths has been to make a comparative analysis of things, and I did that from quite a young age.
And it sounds as though you often did that on your own and sort of did a bit of examination and analysis on your own.
Yes, in the Waikato there weren't a lot of people to talk about things like that. Right. Really, no.
Right. It was rugby, racing and farming.
It was.
Right. So what other interests have you developed, that have sustained you?
Well, I'm very interested in creativity in the form of art making, and in particular painting. I started to paint again being after childhood painting, when in 1998... when my mother had been unwell and I'd had that horrible diagnosis, and I just found I could sit and be creative and that it actually did something. There was a feedback loop, and it wasn't that I sat down and painted and nothing came of it. It was really tremendously satisfying.
Did any of the therapy introduce you to that creativity, or was that something that you were able to grasp hold of yourself?
I grasped hold of it myself because there was a group running in the area that I'm in, and they had been specially formed for people to do art making together, and they exhibited together every year and worked towards that for several months, and then they'd exhibit. And I met these people only a couple of months before that exhibition happened, and I was invited to put artwork in there, and I sold my first artwork, which felt amazing.
Yeah, so that was the first time you'd exhibited, and you had a marketing success.
Yes, so I'm terrible at marketing. I'm definitely better at creativity than marketing. I had some success, and coincidentally, I was in that gallery yesterday, and the person that was there in those days managing was there on that day, and she said, "When are you going to produce some more artwork and exhibit here again?"
How did you feel about that?
I felt excited and terrified. But it was lovely. It was just lovely to pick that up again.
Right. Mm. I mean, I think you were instrumental in setting up a charitable trust at some stage.
I worked with a group of people that did that, the group that I was talking about, that worked, that painted together. We wanted to set up an art centre, and we did set up a charitable trust. We had meetings for, I think it was about 2 years, and we were registered with IRD. And we were up to the point where we were looking for a building when things fell apart. I had become unwell, physically unwell, and a number of other people had life events that just meant that we had folded.
Do you think there might be a chance to resurrect that at some stage?
I'm hopeful.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. So how have these creative pursuits, I mean, there's another one that I do know of that you haven't mentioned, associated with some with Connect Supporting Recovery.
Ah, choir. Yes, I've enjoyed that. I've always enjoyed music making. I've never been very good at it, but even from being a tiny person, I played the ukulele and sang, because I had such a large area to do it, nobody had to hear me.
Just the birds and the bees.
Just the birds, so I could be as terrible as I liked. And I used to buy little songbooks in the 60s with all the hit songs and go out into the countryside and just sing to my heart's content. And now Connect is running a choir, and I've been to every single one since it started. I think there's been about 8 weeks. And I just so look forward to Monday nights now. It's exciting.
And what's the outcome going to be of that? I think you've got a show coming up.
We do. We have a performance at Shared Vision on the Shore, I think, in June. And we're all excited and terrified, because we're not really that good. We're more enthusiastic than good. But it's lovely. It's just really fun to get together with a group of people. And there are people from all sorts of backgrounds coming into that choir.
I think you've got other supports for your own mental health as well. What are some of those?
Some of my supports are, again, in the virtual world. I haven't found that much help getting support from people in the mental health system, and I haven't really done, I've done therapy, but I've always come to a point where I sort of don't get on any further. But I discovered mindfulness by hearing about it within the mental health setting and having a sort of a knee-jerk reaction, can't be doing mindfulness, don't like that. And I found a woman online called Tara Brach. And she's a psychologist, but she also does something called insight meditation. She's a Buddhist woman. And it's just the most helpful thing, I think, that I've heard was the combination of her use of spirituality and reflection and her humanity, acceptance of her humanity.
That taking a slight Buddhist sort of an approach, that's a long way from Jehovah's Witness and Presbyterian and the Salvation Army.
Probably as far as you could get. And I'm still not in any one faith or following, but I've really appreciated learning about Buddhism, so I found it makes a lot of sense to me.
We talked during the workshop about mindfulness, and my understanding of mindfulness is concentrating on something, maybe having a drink and focusing on the liquid going down through your throat and that sort of thing. I believe that the mindfulness you practice is a little bit different to that.
I think it's that, and then there's another dimension to it that I use. I use what you were talking about, because I have trouble with dissociation, which means I have trouble feeling in touch with my body. So I use a sort of sensory, not sensory modulation, because I haven't learned that, but I use the mindfulness to try and feel my fingers and my toes and ground myself. But what I'm talking about with mindfulness is more a process of reflection on what's happening for me inside and outside. So watching what's happening with other people, reflecting on that inside, and doing the same with myself.
So is that a sort of a meditative state? Quiet time?
It is, but it also means I use that in everyday life as well. So it's both a quiet time, and it's something that I employ when I'm with people. So It's like meditation in action, maybe.
Right. Well, that's a good, that's a new term. Yeah, I mean, your view of recovery, and you took the time to send me a separate email about this, and I, you know, I rather like the concept of healing that you talk about in terms of recovery. Do you want to explain a bit more about that?
Well, one of the problems I have with the word recovery, I think, on reflection, is that to recover is to somehow dredge something up that's been before. And why I think I relate more to healing is because it doesn't require something to have been there before and bring it back. So healing to me is a sort of a gentle movement, maybe not forward, maybe a bit sideways and around and around in circles every now and then, but something nurturing.
Yeah. Mm. Where would you assess yourself in terms of healing today?
Where would I assess myself? I think that I've got the best of lots of worlds, and that I have my insight Buddhism, and I have inner resources that I haven't had before. I've had somebody say to me recently that I have a very strong sense of myself, and that was probably because I just disagreed with him and managed it fairly well, because I do have trouble with that, with being able to disagree and feel all right about it. Mm. I think I have a sense of progress. A thing that I find frustrating is the dissociation. I don't like that, but I just try and accept it. I don't think I can change it by will, by forcing it.
I mean, that sort of connects your mental health and your spiritual world with your physical health, I suppose.
Yes, it does. Well, they are all interconnected. I see that. It also it links it with my creativity as well. So I find that I don't separate out my spirituality from my painting. It's quite an organic sort of a process that's connected to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, like minds, of course, funds and supports our Mental Health Radio Show, and like minds is about reducing stigma and discrimination. And, you know, stigma and discrimination has been a hot topic on the news. The whole of TV3's Campbell Live program was linked to the four-year-old boy who had been discriminated against because he was HIV positive. I think his parents admitted to the preschool where he was going that he was HIV positive, and this has caused a huge upheaval in the Whangarei community in many ways, and it's sort of taken on national significance. But it's a very intense example of stigma and discrimination. Has it been a factor in your life in relation to mental health?
I think the instance I found most aggravating was when I saw the psychiatrist and psychologist I talked about earlier, and I discovered that they didn't seem to feel that I was able to make decisions for myself. I had a very strong feeling that they knew better, and that they weren't open to just hearing what I had to say.
How did they respond to your diagnosis?
They responded by telling me about the diagnosis. They knew that I'd done considerable research, as I mentioned before. And I didn't find it entirely helpful, any of what happened with them.
I mean, it sounds as though they almost penalised you for having done all this research.
They did, and I'm hesitating because it's so difficult to put your finger on what's happened. I know at the time I was furious, and I was angry, I was sad, I was humiliated. In fact, humiliation was probably my main feeling from that. I felt intense shame.
Instead of feeling accepted and some empathy or high degree of empathy, which you would hope might have occurred if you go and seek help and support.
Yes, I think the feeling that I have of shame probably indicates the level of stigma that I did encounter.
I mean, what effect has that had in terms of seeking help again if you've needed it?
It's meant that I'm very, very wary.
Right.
And I've tried to become more self-sufficient.
But it sounds as though an association with a community mental health provider like Connect has had a lot of benefits too.
Definitely. So I'm relating to them more as they're a non-government association, which is good. I've had a community support worker through there, and I have had considerable amount of support, and she's sort of bent over backwards to find the way that I do find helpful. And they've also provided a venue for people to run groups from that building using some of their resources. I think that's amazing.
So that's really peer support in action. I mean, getting together with other people with lived experience.
Definitely. I think one of the things that are happening now that wasn't happening in the past was that people are getting together and socialising, and they're talking about experiences, negative ones like we just talked about then, but more just about their lived experience of mental distress, and I think that's really helpful.
So that's one of the benefits of being associated with non-government organisations like Connect and Framework, who I work for, who can provide a venue, if you like, and programs which help people to build their mental health and to build their self-confidence and their self-esteem. And Sharon, I'd like to say particularly how grateful I am that you have been so courageous in firstly coming to the radio training workshop, but also agreeing to do an interview as well. So congratulations.
Thank you, Sheldon. Thank you for offering this opportunity. I think it was, first of all, it was daunting, and afterwards it became quite rewarding. I've enjoyed doing it. It's terrifying, but I learned a lot along the way. Thank you very much for having me here.